folks, welcome to Red Eyes Radio. This is Henrik. I'm glad you found your way to our program today and that we have the opportunity to talk to you once again. Or maybe you're joining us for the first time in these strange times, seeking answers to some of the strangeness. On this program, we discuss many different things, topics that we find both interesting, intriguing, but also important. RedEyesCreations.com and RedEyesMembers.com. That's the websites where you can find more. Today we have Randall Carlson with us to talk about cycles of catastrophe and cosmic patterns. Randall Carlson is a master builder, an architectural designer, teacher, geometrician, geomythologist, geological explorer, and a renegade scholar. He has 4 decades of study, research, and exploration into the interface between ancient mysteries and modern science. He has been an active Freemason for 30 years and is past master of one of the oldest and largest Masonic lodges in Georgia. He has been recognized by the National Science Teachers Association for his commitment to science education for young people. The acclaimed 1997 TBS-CBN documentary Fire from the Sky was based upon his research into Earth changes and catastrophic events. He has organized several dozen field explorations documenting evidence for catastrophic Earth change. He has received academic recognition for outstanding work as a student of geology. His work incorporates ancient mythology, astronomy, earth science, paleontology, symbolism, sacred geometry, architecture, geomancy, and other arcane and scientific traditions. For over 25 years, he has presented classes, lectures, and multimedia programs synthesizing this information for students of the mysteries. It's going to be really interesting, good stuff coming up here. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Randall. It's good to talk to you. Thank you for coming on the program, and I'm looking forward to talking more about your work here today. So thank you for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me, Henrik.
So let's see here. What do you think we need to know here before we kind of get into the good stuff on your work about cosmic patterns and cycles of catastrophe? Maybe you want to share a little bit about your background or the background to the subject matter, Randall. Where do you think we should begin?
Well, I guess we could begin by talking about me. My background is I've studied geology in college, but I'm primarily a builder by profession, and I've just had an ongoing interest in many matters of science, geological, astronomical, archaeological, history, and after about 40 years of an ongoing, somewhat obsessive interest in these subjects, I've kind of come to a certain insights regarding the nature of our position, you know, as we move forward, believing that in order to have a handle on the future, we have to kind of have a pretty clear understanding of the past, where we came from. And so I turn to these various subjects that I find fascinating, and what I look for is the patterns that tie things together. I believe that there tends to be an over-specialization in science today, where it's very difficult for one scientific discipline to understand the language of another scientific discipline. And what I'm looking for is a synthesis to try to understand how studies of geology, for example, may impact studies of history, which they do, of course, because we now know that geology has played a tremendous role or a much more significant role in human history than previously appreciated.
Can you give us an example of that? Is there a quick one you can fetch for us, if you will?
Oh, sure. Well, if we look at the rise of what we consider modern civilization, which goes back to the appearance of cuneiform writing in the Middle East around 5,000 years ago, and we look at we consider that would be the inception of modern history, yet the presence of modern humans on this planet goes back many, many, many times longer than that. There's now been skeletons of modern, thoroughly modern humans in every regard that have been dated to 150 to 180,000 years old. So we have this long span of time in which there's essentially very little record of anything that happened. When we look at the period of time through which humans have existed, we find that we actually endured a whole cycle of glacial and interglacial ages. And if we look at the tempo and timing of these climate changes associated with transitions from glacial to interglacial and back again, we find that the last ice age cycle terminated between about 10 and 13,000 years ago. And if we turn to the activities of humans, we find some interesting correlations there that generally you'll find it in looking at the rise of modern agriculture. It's usually placed at about 10,000 years ago. Dispersion of languages at about 10,000 years ago, the domestication of animals, the appearance of the first cities roughly between 7 and 9,000 years ago. And I think this opens the possibility once, and we can talk about this as we get into the show, the nature of some of the sweeping changes that occurred at the end of the last ice age. It's possible what we're seeing there is not so much the beginning of civilization as we know it, but a rebooting of civilization. So I would think that is a very salient example. And then coming from 10,000 down to about 5,000 years ago into what we now refer to, geologists would refer to as the Holocene epoch, we find that there was a sort of a diminishing crescendo of changes that finally appeared to have stabilized around 5,000 to 6,000 years ago with the present climate. And it's very likely that stabilization of the planetary climate is what allowed settlements to really flourish and what we think of as civilization to begin to take off.
Indeed, and there seems to be hints of these cycles and patterns as well. Both if you look around in the natural world, but also in some of the aspects that early man created. Interesting enough, I might want to ask you about that a little bit later. But in the beginning, I was looking at your cosmic patterns and cycles of catastrophe DVD preview that I have on YouTube as well. And the one of the first things you address is one thing that I've been very interested in for a long time as well. It has to do with the dispersion of language, as you mentioned, or the confusion of lip, as you say in the intro there. The Tower of Babel story. What do you think happened there, Randall?
Well, that's interestingly, that's one of those themes that we find recurring in a lot of different cultural traditions. there's a number of these themes. The Great Flood, for example, which seems to be the most ubiquitous amongst the various ancient traditions that have come down to us. Cultures all over the planet have this story of a great flood that wiped out some previous order of things, and their ancestors were the survivors of this event. Not quite as prevalent, but still found in a considerable number of diverse places, is this idea that there was a universal language. I don't know if that's something to be taken literally. I tend to look at that perhaps more in the light of the language of symbolism, in the sense that, we think of math today as being a sort of a universal language because the principles of mathematics and geometry are consistent regardless of, what our ethnic background or our social background is. And it seems that all cultures that I have studied in the past were very interested, almost obsessed, if you will, with symbolism on some level or another, whether it was in their sacred writings, whether it was in ritual, whether it was expressed through their architecture. And so I kind of tend to think in terms of the universal language being symbolism. And it's clear that from looking at these stories that there may have been some effort on the part of man to aspire to something much greater than perhaps given credit for, yet some natural event or catastrophe intervened to circumvent this aspiration. Whether it was actually literally a tower or not is difficult to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's certainly possible that when you would have an event like this that could cause the physical dispersion of various groups of people, that within a few generations, the language, of course, is going to begin to diversify to the point where, it will evolve to where at some point it'll become very difficult for one group isolated from another group to communicate any longer. I don't necessarily think it implies that it was like an instantaneous process, but it may have been something that happened, you know, over a matter of centuries. And it could have been a result of some kind of a natural event that, you know, terminated some grand social experiment that was underway at the time.
You know, the Bible's account has this in the context of God, or the gods, actually, in plural, as you point out. But do you think that these stories are literal, that this is what actually happened, that someone else intervened maybe in unison with the catastrophe? Or do you think that these are stories that are supposed to talk about and represent, again, symbolically, then natural forces that were happening at the time that caused our, you know, previous civilization, then, if you will, to collapse, basically?
Yeah, I think that there's a I definitely think there's a literal component to it. I think that there are, my reading of this would be that there are actual events that have occurred, and then overlaid on those are, you know, moral teachings and projections from the folks that have preserved these stories. I do tend to believe, though, that most of these stories do have some type of a literal reality to them. You know, whether it's the story of Sodom and Gomorrah or the story of the Great Flood, which, you know, having studied catastrophist geology now for about 30 years, I'm convinced that, you know, not in the sense that you know, a fundamentalist may look at it and think of a universal flood of, you know, uniformly covering all the world's mountains to whatever depth. But, you know, we now know that, you know, there have been floods on a scale that at least in terms of regionally, survivors of such events, for all their awareness, it could have destroyed the whole world, or in a sense, it destroyed their whole world. And we should talk about that at some, you know, somewhat, in the program here. Because there, one of the, it's an interesting, quote by some, paleohydrologists, Victor Baker and, Rudoy, who is a Soviet paleohydrologist who've studied into some of these ancient cataclysmic events involving gigantic floods. And they have stated pretty convincingly through their research that they actually refer to it as planetary scale movement of water. And this is something that seems to have been missed by a lot of historians and, you know, folks that look at the and try to assemble the story of humankind without realizing that there have been events. And we're talking about hydrological events that would involve the conveyance of billions of cubic feet of water per second, which is completely outside of our modern experience. And yet, when you realize the scale of these kinds of events, it's apparent that, you know, anyone who survived a flood of this magnitude could easily be convinced that they were the only ones. To answer your question, yeah, I think that there's definitely a literal component to these stories. But that doesn't mean that there's been a lot of symbolism and moral traditions or teachings grafted onto them.
Oh, for sure. Now, planetary scale with the movement of water, what could that be that creates something huge like that, do you think, Randall?
Well, from my perspective, I think about it this way. If you want to create if you want to drown the world, here's how you do it. You spend about 10,000 years drawing water out of the oceans and locking it up on land in the form of an ice cap, let's say 2 miles thick. So when you pull out, say, 6 to 7 million cubic miles of water out of the ocean and lock it up on land, you create a tremendous potential energy there. When you think of a 1 mile cubic ice cube, and you lift the thing up a mile above the surface of the ground to an altitude of a mile, you've created a tremendous potential energy there. Now imagine that you could suddenly release that, that water that's locked up in the ice. And in effect, what we see is that, at the end of the last ice age, we have a meltdown of the great ice sheets that was inexplicably fast, beyond anything that allows itself of any kind of an explanation. Actually, in the early 70s, with the advent of radiocarbon dating, which became a viable technology in the 1950s, it had become apparent to glaciologists and climatologists and so on that the melting of the ice, the disappearance of this huge volume of ice, which was actually greater than the mass of ice now covering the South Pole, was so rapid that the energy sources required apparently didn't exist. You know, in the older concepts, the ice, it was imagined that the ice essentially disappeared uniformly and relatively smoothly over a period of about 40 or 50,000 years. And then that would be consistent with what scientists had seen at the end of the Little Ice Age, which, you know, terminated between about the mid-18th to mid-19th century, in which glaciers worldwide were seen to begin regressing at a relatively uniform pace. Mm-hmm. By making those observations, they extrapolated from that back to the Great Ice Age and assumed, well, at the rates we've seen the glaciers receding, let's say between 1750 and 1900, we can extrapolate back and we can imagine that these great ice sheets are receding at a similar rate and would therefore take, you know, so many tens of thousands of years to completely dissipate. Well, with radiocarbon dating, that nice, smooth model got thrown into disarray because it was realized that down to about 14 or 15,000 years ago, the great ice sheets were there and fully intact and at their greatest mass. And then by 8 to 10,000 years ago, they were gone. And so the problem became this, is that in order to convert this mass of ice into water, it requires thermal energy. So they started doing some calculations to try to determine just how much thermal energy. And the problem was that there was nowhere on Earth where there was enough thermal energy available from terrestrial sources or normal solar sources to melt the ice that fast. And they referred to this as the energy paradox. And there were several studies published between 1973 and 1975 where they were addressing this energy paradox. And looking at the current climate of Canada, let's say, where most of the great Laurentide and Cordilleran ice sheets were located, as they have been called, given the present climate, if you were to take an ice sheet, let's say the size of Antarctica, place it over Canada with the present environment, it would take literally 30 to 40,000 years to melt the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
Because you figure that it's only got 3 months out of the year that it's actually going to be melting, 4 months maybe.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the year, you know, it's actually going to be recouping some of its mass through the form of snowfall. And then come spring, it'll start melting again. So they realized, well, it couldn't have been a shift from a polar climate, which would have been necessary to sustain that ice mass, to the present climate, because obviously the ice would still be there. It would be diminished in size, but it would still be there. So then they looked at where on Earth was the greatest budget of thermal energy available, and that was over tropical oceans. And given so now if you take the entire ice mass, displace it from Canada and put it flanking the equator, and it begins to melt, it's still going to take on the order of 20,000 years to melt the whole thing. So you can see where here's where the conundrum came in. And so they referred to this as the energy paradox. And eventually in 75, there was a conference held, and they said, well, there must be an error in the data somewhere, or there's something we're overlooking, so let's just put this on the shelf and get back to it later. And really, they've never gotten back to it.
Wow.
And what's happened is, even, let's say, if we allow between 14,000 and 8,000 years, that's 6,000 years. Within that 6,000 years that the ice pretty much completely disappeared, it was not a smooth process either. It was a pulsed process. Within that, there were apparently two great melting episodes in which a significant percentage of the ice disappeared very rapidly. And then there was actually several hiatuses of melting between these, what's referred to as Meltwater Pulse 1A and Meltwater Pulse 1B. And this has been it's been reflected in the studies of sea level rise, because it was apparent that sea level didn't rise uniformly. Geologists, marine geologists have referred to these as CREs, or catastrophic rise events. And apparently the catastrophic rise events would be associated with melting events of the ice, because, you know, as the ice melts, it dumps its water back into the ocean basins, and ocean levels rise. And so we're kind of faced with this situation that we've got these extraordinary events, and there is not a ready explanation for these at hand. What I'm trying to do, is part of my work, is trying to get people to appreciate and realize how extraordinary some of these changes were, and that they were the level at which they occurred. It's absolutely necessary to factor these into our thinking about our own story on this planet. Because another factor about this timing is that it was in this interval right between meltwater pulse 1A and 1B that we have an associated climate change. We have a transition from what's known as the Balling-Alarod, which was a warming at the end of the last ice age, which began around 15,000 years ago, sort of what we would think of as a normal gradual warming. It began about 15,000 years ago and was progressing relatively smoothly till about 13,000 years ago, and then it was suddenly interrupted by this extreme warming event. And then that extreme warming event was followed by a return to full glacial cold that lasted about 1,400 years, that's called the Younger Dryas. Then the Younger Dryas was terminated by another extreme warming event it's referred to as the Younger Dryas pre-boreal transition. And so you have these two extreme warming events. Let me recapitulate the scenario.
Mm-hmm.
The ice age seems to be undergoing a sort of the normal transition. The normal climate shift is beginning. The ice is diminished from its greatest extent, which was between 15 and 18,000 years ago. It's diminished to maybe 85 or 90% of its maximum mass. And then suddenly this nice orderly transition is interrupted by this sudden extreme warming event. We're talking about maybe 15 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit in less than 5 years. This would be undoubtedly associated and correlated with the first meltwater pulse. Okay, now, after that, the climate jerks back into full glacial cold as it was during the greatest depth of the ice age, let's say 18,000 years ago. This full glacial cold, called the Younger Dryas, after a polar wildflower, which had disappeared in northern Europe, suddenly makes a rapid return. After this 1,400-year cold snap, there's a second extreme warming event, and this is what essentially kicks the planet out of the grip of the ice age. It's almost as if it was two jerks that took required to get the planet out of the ice age. Interestingly, in that interval between roughly 13,000 years ago and 1,400 years later, 11,600 years, is when all the great megafauna disappeared. And this is an extraordinary event that I don't think has been adequately explained. The dominant explanation up to this point for the disappearance of the great megafauna, the great mammals that lived on the planet during the ice age, was human hunting. Yet as more and more evidence begins to accrue, that explanation becomes less viable.
Yeah.
And we're faced with, the extinction, to put it in perspective, roughly about 130 species of mega mammals disappeared globally at the end of the Pleistocene, which was the end of the last ice age. When we talk about a mega mammal, the definition is about 44 kilograms or about 100 pounds in body weight. If we count all of the numbers of species of mega mammals on the planet today, it's roughly equivalent to the number that disappeared suddenly at the end of the last ice age. And if we look at the fauna of the last ice age, what we find in America, for example, the only modern parallel for the density of great mammalian life would be the Serengeti Plain of Africa. I talk to, Americans all the time who have absolutely no clue that a few thousand years ago there were three species of elephants living in America, and there were camels and ground sloths the size of modern-day elephants, and beavers that weighed 600 pounds, and was the size of, you know, Volkswagen Beetle cars and on and on and on. But those mammals suddenly disappeared. And they disappeared precisely within that window of extreme climate change. And so there's another event that, to me, ties in with that helps us to understand how extreme some of these events must have been. Because, first of all, when you think about large mammals, they're the ones – large mammals require a greater range of habitat to survive. They require, obviously, more food. You know, an elephant and presumably a woolly mammoth as well requires about – you know, at least 500 pounds of food per day. So when you destroy habitat, you know, you've basically denied these animals their food source. In addition, of course, their generational turnover time is much longer. Their gestation time in the womb is much longer. The time at which the young have to be nurtured is much longer. And all of these things are going to be dependent upon a stable habitat or a stable environment. And when we look at the extreme nature of some of the changes that occurred at the end of the last ice age, and the loss of habitat that would have accompanied those changes, I think it's really a diversion to try to attribute the loss of the mega mammals to human hunting, because the way I see it, humans would have been as much a victim of these climate changes as the great animals were.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a reason for this. If we go to the root of the problem, if you will, it's about energy then, as you say. In your view, anything that can explain this? Can we go to Charles Hapgood and look at the Earth crustal displacement? Can we talk about immense solar activity? Or what do you think, Randall?
Well, now bringing up Charles Hapgood is very interesting, because when I was really getting started in my catastrophist studies in the 70s, he was one of my primary sources. And I considered the idea of pole shift as being a viable explanation. You know, now his version of pole shift is not the entire planet shifting. It's essentially the crust or the lithosphere becoming displaced over the mantle. As I learned more, I kind of began to believe that that was not the explanation. And yet several of the points that he brought up are very interesting and still don't seem to have any adequate explanation. For example, if you look at the geographic configuration of the last great ice mass, you see that it was centered over Hudson Bay, and it was at its thickest over Hudson Bay. And Hudson Bay is essentially the remnant of the depression where the Earth's crust was isostatically depressed under the weight of this great ice sheet. And you actually now, the studies of the growth of the glaciers, of the ice masses, show that it didn't, in the early conceptions, it was imagined that the ice grew southward from the polar regions. It didn't. It grew actually from a nucleus adjacent to Hudson Bay, and it grew north as well as it grew south, east, and west. So, and when we look at the extent of the ice and actually if we were to place a compass on the center of the ice mass at Hudson Bay and to draw a circle circumscribing the ice mass, what we actually see is that essentially it's very close to the circle that would be defined by the Arctic Circle. So, it supports the idea that perhaps that Hudson Bay was actually at the polar region.
Oh, and there is magnetic anomalies in the area to this day, isn't there? This is believed to be the previous magnetic pole over Hudson Bay, correct?
Yes, and it's interesting that the magnetic pole is migrating actually towards what is now the geographic pole. Here's what I tend to think is that the shifting of the Earth's crust, a la Charles Hapgood, was not the cause of the event, but was a consequence of the event. Because what you have to appreciate is that ice loading causes a tremendous depression in the Earth's crust. And when you remove the ice, it causes a rise of the Earth's crust. This is called isostatic compensation or isostatic adjustment. It's the same as if, you know, you're sitting down on a soft chair, a cushion, and the cushion depresses while you're sitting on it, and when you stand up, the cushion begins to come back to assume its former shape.
Right.
As much as the isostatic depression in the area of the center of the ice mass was as much as 1,500 feet or more, And this was over, literally over, you know, hundreds of thousands of square miles where it was this extreme depression. Now, because of the Earth spinning on its axis, the centrifugal force essentially throws the mass of the Earth towards the equator, right? So that you're probably aware of the fact that the equatorial diameter of the Earth is about 26 miles greater than the polar diameter.
That's right. Yeah. Do you think that the ice also on the poles adds to that? It's a dual force. It's the centrifugal force, the spin, and then it's also the ice on the polar caps. It squeezes the Earth together like an oval almost, correct?
Yes, and this mass of ice tends, I think, to destabilize it, you know, in the sense that Hapgood envisioned it. But now what happens if you rapidly remove that ice, the crust starts rebounding and essentially is moving away from the Earth's center of gravity. Well, I suspect this would induce an instability in the Earth's crust because, like, for example, right now, as the Earth spins, any given region of the Earth's crust, its distance from the Earth's center of gravity is relative to its latitude, right?
Yep.
Now, supposing you depress a large section of the Earth's crust so that it's, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 feet closer to the Earth's center of gravity, and then you suddenly release that weight, the land begins rebounding. It's now no longer in the position it would be occupying under normal circumstances. And I think this is going to create a centrifugal throw on this particular region of the Earth's crust, which would induce its migration towards a latitude that is more commensurate with its distance from the Earth's center of mass. So if, in other words, if we're at the polar, let's say that the Hudson Bay is at the polar region and suddenly it's, you know, suddenly in the geological sense, it's 2,000 feet further away from the Earth's center of mass. This is going to induce a stability. And what it's going to want to do is it's going to want to begin to migrate to a position that would be its natural position at that distance from the Earth's center of mass, which, of course, would be at a more southerly latitude. So I think that you could actually, going vertical, isostatic changes in the Earth's crust, you can actually induce lateral changes in the Earth's, the movement of the Earth's crust. And it's in that context that I tend to think that the shifting of the plates relative to the equators and the poles would have been a consequence of this tremendous redistribution of mass that occurred on the Earth's surface with the rapid melting of the ice sheet and the consequent loading back into the ocean basins. And I'll also mention that as the land is rising isostatically and this weight is being released and put back into the ocean basins, there will be a corresponding isostatic depression of the ocean bottoms. And that will be particularly concentrated along the zones of least resistance, which are going to be along the plate margins. So I suspect, and there is empirical evidence to support this conclusion, that there may have been a massive isostatic subsidence along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is interesting, which brings us into sort of like questions of perhaps, you know, Atlantis.
Yeah, for sure. So if we for a moment again go back to what is melting the ice, what do you think, Randall?
Okay, you brought up some interesting possibilities. Solar flares, some kind of a massive solar output, that certainly is a possibility. Now, Robert Schock, I believe in his book that's coming out, it may have come out now. I think that's what he's proposing, and I'm looking forward to reading that book to see what his evidence that he amasses for that. I tend to think that what the conclusion that I came to several decades ago was it was probably an extraterrestrial encounter event. It seems to me the most likely explanation, the most prosaic explanation, would be something along the lines of maybe a mini Shoemaker-Levy 9 type event.
But Earth directed with intention.
Pardon me?
But Earth directed with intention.
With intention? You mean as if, that's an interesting idea. If I think I'm...
Oh, no, okay. No, now I see where we're going. I see. I missed... See, I missed. I thought first that you were implying that someone else had done it, someone with intelligence out there. But I see what you're saying now. You're just talking about, a comet in itself. But we can certainly touch upon the idea if it was earthbound with intention later, if you will. But go ahead with the first part of that, if you will.
I was going to say that's an idea sometimes I consider late at night when I'm myself in the dark and yeah. I don't know.
Helps to sleep, all right?
Well, before we go there, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily have to be a directed event. I mean,
sure, yeah.
Yet, as we get into this, the whole thing is so strange and anomalous that I think that no explanation is too exotic at this point to invoke. But essentially, there is, I don't know if you've ever heard of this phenomena that's in the southeastern United States called the Carolina Bays.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've got some information about that posted on my website, and actually in the last few years, quite a bit of information has shown up on the internet regarding the Carolina Bays. When I first started studying them in the early 80s, there was not much information available, but they're a geomorphic phenomena that's here found in the southeastern United States where I live.
I've heard about this. It's very interesting. It's it looks like man-made depressions, I guess, in the landscape. Correct?
Yes, they almost look like giant thumbprints. They're oval or elliptical. There's thousands of them over covering the southeastern coastal plain of the United States. They reach from Virginia to Florida. They're particularly concentrated in the Carolinas, and that's why they're referred to as Carolina Bays. They're not actually in the ocean. They take their name from a tree that typically grows within the bays called the Bay Tree. And so because of the ubiquitous presence of this tree, they come to be called the Carolina Bays. But over the years, a number of controversies have arisen over the origin of these Carolina Bays. They were first discovered in the early 1930s when, shortly after Franklin Roosevelt became president, he commissioned an aerial, actually one of the very first aerial surveys ever performed. I think it was in 1933. And they were going to, they surveyed an area near Myrtle Beach, North Carolina. Or is it South Carolina? It's right on the border there. In any case, it's a Horton County, it's called. And it was about 500 square miles. And in typical fashion, the airplane flies over the terrain, taking a series of photographs. The photographs were sent to the New York office of the Fairfield Aerial Surveys, I think they were called. And the gentleman who was in charge of assembling the mosaic of photographs was essentially the first to see that there was this phenomena that regarding the bays that were you couldn't see from the ground, and that they were all essentially perfect ellipses, and the long axes of the ellipses were also aligned with almost perfect parallelism. And his first impression on looking at it was that it was something that had been superimposed upon the landscape from above, and he actually speculated that perhaps it was a result of a great meteor shower. He then contacted a geologist friend of his, I think that was out of, if I'm recalling, was out of the University of Oklahoma, named Frank Melton, I think was his name.
Mm-hmm.
And Melton brought in his senior, I think one of his professors named William Shriver. So Melton and Shriver came and spent a season studying the Carolina Bays, and wrote a paper, a classic geological paper, I think it came out maybe 34 or 35, entitled Carolina Bays, Are They Meteorite Scars? And in this paper, they speculate that there was a great meteor shower, and at the time, they were envisioning that the meteorites would have actually struck the ground at a very low angle, and it was this low angle to the ground that caused the crater forms to be oblique or elliptical rather than circular, which is the shape we normally associate with cratering. over the next couple of years, a number of other geologists looked at them and concluded that they were consistent with a, you know, some kind of a meteor shower. But then there was a reaction to that because obviously this was contrary to the uniformitarian doctrines of earth change that pretty much dominated the discussion totally back in the 1930s. And there arose essentially two camps. One camp that argued in favor of some type of an extraterrestrial event, and another camp that was arguing that they could be explained by reference to more normal geomorphic processes. So the two camps became known as the Celestials and the Terrestrials. The Terrestrials were led by Douglas Johnson, who was considered the Dean of American Geomorphology out of Columbia University. And after a number of years of study, he wrote a massive tome called The Origin of the Carolina Bays. And he concocted a theory that essentially involved every geomorphic process known to man, plus a few that he invented. And his theory that he invoked to explain the origin of the Carolina Bays was the complex theory, for short. And what that was short for was the longer version of the theory, which was the Artesian Solution Lacustrine Aeolian Theory, which essentially said you start with artesian wells under flowing down dip, which means towards the tilt of the bedrock, which in the southeastern United States, most of the bedrock is limestone in that particular area, and it tilts to the southeast, which is the direction of the long axes of the bay. So he theorized that water was flowing under the strata of limestone. It would reach an aperture, and under pressure would then turn 90 degrees or so and flow up towards the surface, almost like an upside-down waterfall. Once it reached the surface, it would cause the land in that region to dissolve and subside, forming a depression, which then filled with a lake. The wind now, which was the Aeolian, that was the lacustrine part of the theory, the now would blow on the lake, and the waves would slowly smooth the shoreline into these elliptical shapes. And given that his theory was so complex, and given that Douglas Johnson was considered the dean of American geomorphology, all of those folks that had problems with things falling out of the sky pretty much all got together and said, well, hey, this is Douglas Johnson, and look at this fat 350-page book that he wrote.
That's got to be true, right?
Yeah. And so essentially what happened was after about 20 years of controversy, the terrestrials came to dominate. And the celestial theory did evolve, though. After the Melton and Shriver passed from the scene, a man by the name of William F. Prouty took over, a geologist. And by this time, by the time we get into the 40s and 50s, American scientists were becoming aware of the Tunguska event of 1908 in Siberia. And it was understood now that in the case of that event, the object didn't actually strike the ground. It detonated in the atmosphere and was able to create a tremendous amount of devastation by blowing up 5 miles in the atmosphere, and created tremendous pressure waves, which when impacting the Earth, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with that event to some extent.
For sure. Yeah.
Blasted down the trees. And when you actually look at the pattern, it's a butterfly pattern, but it actually is like as if it looks as if it's two ellipses kind of superimposed over each other. And in any case, so William Prouty, he and his colleagues, they were studying the Tunguska event, and they evolved the theory, the meteorite theory of the Carolina Bay origins, to the idea that these were objects that were spalling off of a disintegrating comet nucleus and actually detonating in the atmosphere. And given that the coastal plain of the southeastern United States is all sandy, it's unconsolidated, essentially their theory was you could almost liken the Carolina Bays to blowout holes. The extraordinary pressure of these atmospheric detonations impacting, again, coming in at a low angle to the atmosphere, could cause the scooping out, the hollowing out of the bays.
Right.
And it appeared from the studies that commenced in the 1950s that they all appeared to be about of the same age, because when they started taking samples of the bottom, the infill, the peat and the organic material that had collected in them was generally all showing up to be about terminal Pleistocene in age, which, you know, puts them essentially commensurate with that, you know, the great climate changes that we were talking about earlier. And
so would this be enough of the energy, this event alone, or is this just one of potentially many impacts on different places around the world?
Here's the thing, Heinrich. When you begin to look at the distribution of the bays, you realize that, you know, with some deviations, the axes trend from roughly southeast to northwest at a 45-degree angle to the equator. So, and they're also pretty much superimposed over the sandy, unconsolidated coastal plain. And obviously to the southeast, you have ocean. And if you look at them like aerial photographs of these, what you see is that they disappear as you go into the ocean. So, you know, if we were at the end of the last ice age and ocean level is 400 feet lower, well, the coastal plain is going to extend, at least in the case of the southeastern United States, in some cases up to 50 to 100 miles further east.
Oh, wow.
May have been many, many more of these Carolina bays out, extending out, that are now drowned by the rising sea level.
Right.
Conversely, when you come to the northwest and you begin to rise in elevation, you come up out of the coastal plain into a much more consolidated terrain with a lot more granite and bedrock and so forth. What you see is that the Carolina bays fade out. And you can actually look at photographs. I refer to them as ghost bays, where you can barely see the impression, but it's still there. Once you've looked at, you know, pictures of hundreds of these things, you know, in the coastal plain region, say within 20 or 30 miles of the present coastline, they're very distinct, very prominent. Then as you move upland and the ground becomes harder and more resistant, what you see is that they disappear again. So what I concluded was, well, most of the researchers looking at these concluded that it was a phenomenon that was pretty much limited to the coastal plain, even the celestial camp. But it's clear to me that had you had aerial explosions further to the northwest, let's say, you know, over Kentucky, Ohio, and so forth, you're not going to have those elegant elliptical-shaped bowls anymore. That's going to be a consequence of the unconsolidated sandy sediments that comprise the coastal plain. Well, what I did in my thinking about this, I thought, well, let's see now. If this was, in fact, a celestial event, a disintegrating comet nucleus spalling enormous amounts of debris, if it came in the alignment of the axes of these things would be an indicator of the direction from that the object came into the Earth's atmosphere,
yep,
the northwest. So we're going back here now to about, during the 1980s. So I took maps and I just began to draw pathways on the maps, showing what I thought would have been a path of entry. And of course, it led directly over the Great Lakes region, directly over Canada. And right on up, if you follow the path right on, northwest, it would pass right over Canada and over Alaska and actually pass over the northern coastal plain of Alaska, the region where Prudhoe Bay is roughly. And so I thought, okay, this is interesting. Now, if this was a phenomenon and it was celestial and coming in from space, and if it was not limited to the coastal plain, can we look at see anything anomalous that would have occurred relative to the ice sheet? Well, this is when I began to turn my attention to studying what was now known. And, you know, we're looking, I guess, early 80s at this point. And by the early 80s, there had certainly began to information began it was by that time emerging that, yeah, there was some pretty rapid melting of the ice sheets that had occurred. Not as rapid as is now recognized, but so this led me to an interest in, well, if there was rapid melting, then obviously there would have been extreme flooding. And this is when I got back to my interest in what is typically known as the Missoula Flood or Missoula Floods, which until recent discoveries in the Altay Mountain region of Siberia, Mongolia, these were considered to be the largest freshwater floods ever documented in the history of the Earth. And they occurred in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. And I had traveled in that region when I was just a young man out of high school in 1970. I spent the summer out in the Pacific Northwest traveling and hiking. And I had seen some of these spectacular flood-created landscapes without, you know, having the slightest clue as to what was actually the cause of these landscapes. So But they stayed in the back of my mind. They made such an impression on me, you know, back then that I never forgot. And I always thought, you know what, I'm going to go back out there one of the days and spend some time, you know, looking at those landscapes again, the Columbia Gorge, what is known as Scabland in southeastern Washington. But in any case, when I began to look at evidence for any anomalous melting type events associated with the ice, that's when I kind of encountered this Missoula flood phenomena. So I said, well, there we go. Here's something that seems to be the consequence of an extreme melting. But as I began to look into it, I found that the dominant theory was that, well, there was a giant glacial lake held in by an ice dam, and the ice dam gave way. So I began looking into this in much more depth and actually started making multiple field trips out to that region and actually traversed, oh, perhaps 15,000 miles of the landscape over a period of about 15 years. By foot, by four-wheel drive primarily. Also did multiple flyovers, in small aircraft so I could get the overview of the land. What we would do is rent an airplane for an afternoon and fly over a region, photographing and videotaping. Then the following day we would head out into the same terrain with four-wheel drive vehicle. And I began to collect, just as I did with the Hapgood's work. I went after all of the references and read all the references that he had that I could find. When I began studying the Carolina Bays, I went and dug up over 100 references, which was most of the published material on the Carolina Bays, and collected all of that, studied it all. I did the same thing with the Missoula flood phenomena, and I concluded that the prevailing theory that there was a large glacial lake held in by an ice dam was not a plausible theory. And so I set about to demonstrate by collecting field evidence that I felt was inconsistent with that theory. And that's probably going to be my first published work, is attempting to refute the prevailing theory about the Missoula flood and attribute it to not so much the breaking of a glacial lake out of an ice dam, but to a catastrophic melting of the Cordilleran ice sheet over the Rockies. And what I've done is multiple times traced the pathway of the floodwaters, because, you know, when you've got you've got a picture now, we're talking about a flood wave moving across the landscape that in many places is 600 to 1,000 feet deep. In the region of the Clark Fork River Valley, which is in northwestern Montana, flows across and dumps into Lake Pend'Oreille in northern Idaho. It's a relatively small river, probably 40 to 50,000 cubic feet per second, even at flood levels. So it's not a big river. I don't know what rivers would be in your region that I could compare it to.
I would have to see that myself or have the map or something and look. But
for a temporary period of time, this river flowed 7 miles wide and 2,000 feet deep.
Okay, wow.
Now, there's no river on Earth today that even remotely approaches that. And this was only one of these multiple flows that were apparently coming off of the ice sheet. And so I've traversed this region pretty extensively and, taken thousands of photographs and many, many hours of video footage. Some of those photographs are posted on the Cosmographic Research website. So if somebody wants to actually go there, and I've got some interesting background information on the Missoula flood, and I think I've also got some photographs of the Carolina Bays up there. So if anybody actually wants to, see what we're talking about visually, they can find that on the website.
That's great. Now, I think we're kind of in the middle of something, and definitely if you want to, you know, just finish up that thought, if you will, we should take a little break here between the segments, of course, Randall, but in short, do you want to like summarize a little bit of how you perceive that this was made? How did this happen, basically? What's the explanation in your view, if you have one yet?
Yeah, well, that's excuse me, that's what I'm working on. And since then, since I commenced my studies on the Missoula flood, there's been a lot more information coming to light that was not the only region that experienced these tremendous meltwater floods. And in fact, in North America, every single river valley that heads onto what was the former site of the ice sheet has evidence of gigantic floods. Gigantic floods course down the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
Just extraordinary floods. The river flowing several hundred feet deeper than it has been ever documented to flow at modern peak floods.
And so this has carved the landscape in an extraordinary way, and potentially even pretty quick, correct? Not over millions of years.
Over millions of years, but over, I mean, we'd be literally talking weeks, days.
Wow. Yeah.
Every single major river valley in North America shows evidence of catastrophic flooding on a scale unlike anything seen in historical times. And these are even rivers that were not directly contiguous with the ice sheet itself. If you can go, I've spent a lot of time in the southwestern deserts of the U.S., and everywhere you look is the evidence of hydrological phenomena. There is there are what is referred to as bed forms that are essentially merely massive current ripples, the kind you would see walking on a beach or a sandbar next to a river.
Mm.
And they're ubiquitous over the desert floor. When you traverse the various arroyos, which are the modern erosional gullies that have occurred in the desert in the last 100 to 200 years, you can get a real impressive transect of the architecture of the desert floor. And what you see is that once you go below the surface, the understory of the desert is essentially all water-laid material. There's also, evidence that around the end of the last ice age, there were giant temporary lakes that formed all over the now arid desert regions of the southeastern United States, probably the most well-known being Lake Bonneville, of which the Great Salt Lake in Utah is just a remnant, a mere puddle. But this was a gigantic lake that temporarily formed, and then it overflowed a spillway on its northern boundary.
Mm-hmm.
A gigantic flood known as the Bonneville Flood, which carved out the modern Snake River Canyon. You can find, again, every river valley pretty much in North America extending from the ice sheets itself, even rivers such as the Mackenzie and Yukon River flowing, which would have been flowing from the northern margin of the ice sheets, have evidence of these gigantic meltwater flows. The St. Lawrence flowing into the Atlantic also has the same thing. So what it appears is if the entire ice sheet was undergoing this massive melting event. John Shaw is a Canadian geologist, I believe, out of Calgary, who has documented that there were these enormous, refers to as subglacial floods that were formed under extraordinary pressure and then extruded out from the margins of the ice sheet. In one case, what he refers to as the Livingstone Lake event produced a total discharge of in the neighborhood of 84,000 cubic kilometers of water. These are just extraordinary events that, again, cannot be explained by normal terrestrial processes. Now, what I've done is I've gone in and I've said, okay, if there was an extraterrestrial event, which to me seems to be, something that's no longer exotic. It may have been considered exotic 30 or 40 years ago, but at this point, you know, to anybody who challenges me on it and says, no, this is way too exotic, I say, well, go outside on a very clear night, full moon, get a pair of high-powered binoculars and look at the surface of the moon. You know, and what that's telling us is pretty loud and clear that, you know, impact events are pretty
plentiful, yeah.
And there's no reason to assume that Earth hasn't been had its share of impacts as well. I mean, I've seen some studies that would suggest that the Earth is perhaps 80 times more susceptible to impacts than the Moon. And just because of its larger gravitational attraction and larger, essentially, cross-section. But yeah. When you look at the Earth, we don't see the kinds of cratering as we do on the Moon. But if we could strip away the vegetation and the landforms and the oceans and stuff, we would begin to see a landscape that looked much more like the lunar surface if we could strip away and look at just the bedrock.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, plate tectonics, you know, and the fact that we've got such an active crust, you know, movement of the crust, volcanism and so forth, all of these processes work to obscure the effects of these cosmic impact events. But certainly, as we're beginning to get ever greater ability to study the Earth's crust, what we're seeing is that the crust of the Earth is characterized by hundreds of gigantic circular or arcuate features, which are almost certainly remnants of impacts that have been ongoing since the beginning of the planet and probably right on down to the present day. So to invoke the idea of an impact as a possible cause for the termination of the ice age or a mass extinction event or melting event of an ice cap is not an exotic idea in my mind.
Oh, no, not at all. I want to, in the next hour, ask you a little bit more about some of these the evidence that's come out about this. But for now, I can't believe how quick, by the way, this first hour went by. This is very interesting. We have much more to talk about, Randall, and we are going to do so in the next hour together with you about cosmic patterns and cycles of catastrophe and these cosmic impact events, of course. But before we do that, let's talk about your DVD project and your websites as well. I want to give out those first. Cosmographic Research.
Cosmographic Research. Yeah, that's a website that I put up with my brother, we work together, that basically is just to give folks, you know, kind of some insight. There's a number of articles up there dealing with sort of the overview of catastrophism and its relevance to modern history and so forth. And then I may let Cameron tell you about Sacred Geometry International because he's the one been putting that together. And it's basically dealing with the pattern part of this process. And in the second segment, we can talk about the connection of the, you know, because a lot of people say, well, wait a second, you're talking about catastrophism and floods and asteroid impacts. What's that have to do with, you know, sacred geometry or ancient architecture? So I try to, you know, show that, well, again, you know, what I'm interested in is the synthesis of these divergent areas of knowledge. And that's where we get into the idea of cycles and periodicities. And we can talk about the phenomena of the great year and so forth.
Indeed, that's very interesting stuff. Now, let's talk a little bit about the website. I want to ask you, Cameron, are you with us, by the way?
I'm going to turn it over to Cameron right here.
I'm here, yes.
Really good. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about the websites and obviously the DVD project that you guys are working on as well, because that seems really fascinating. It goes by the name of Cosmic Patterns and Cycles of Catastrophe that we mentioned now. But the website is sacredgeometryinternational.com, and you guys have more information about the DVD project there. Tell us a bit about it.
Well, you know, obviously Randall is a treasure trove of information, and what we want to do is create an online social network where different open-minded researchers around the world can converge and share notes. And the DVD is a means to announce some of his discoveries in a form where they can be easily understood, studied, and distributed so that this type of information can promulgate itself around the world.
Indeed, it's important stuff at this point as well. And is everything ready to go, or are you guys still working on some of the aspects here of the film, the DVD?
It's still being edited and put together, but it will be launching on December 21st, 2012.
Good date. Just a coincidence, right?
Just a coincidence.
Yeah, nothing to worry about. No, that's really good. Can people pre-order the DVD if they want to do that at this stage? Or what?
Yes, you know, people are welcome to visit the website, and, you know, it's in development, so a lot of the material that is hinted at, it's not there in its full form yet, and that's what we're developing and hoping to fund the ability to focus on producing that research and getting it out there in papers and articles and books and other media. So like you, we ask people who are interested and so inclined to support us. They can pre-order the DVD. They can also just donate if they like. And all the money raised goes to producing the DVD and finishing that out. But no matter what, it will be ready December 21st, 2012.
Right, really good. And I encourage people to take a preview look as well. You guys have some YouTube clips out there currently, so you can kind of get a feel of what we're talking about here. The website, again, on Sacred Geometry International. com. Do head on over there, take a look and see if you like it. All right, well, thank you for that, Cameron, and also to you, Randall, of course. We're going to take a short break here, and we're going to return shortly with much more, so stay with us. We are going to continue for another 2 hours with Randall Carlson on redicemembers.com, our members' website. We have much more to discuss about the cycles of catastrophe and the many dramatic changes that the Earth has gone through. We are going to talk more about what is driving the cycles. And later we're going to get into a little bit on numerology, geometry, and the cosmic patterns. At redicemembers.com, we have much more for you. Sign up for a membership and get full access. €5 per month. We have subscriptions from 3 months up to 2 years available for you. And by the way, next on Red Ice Radio, we have Charles Upton, Santos Bonacci, Joseph Atwill with Fritz Heed and Niola Sparkis. After this, Larkin Rose, Katie Diolos and Douglas Dietrich, to name a few. We hope to have you with us again when we're back with more in just a few days. In the meantime, stay tuned to redicecreations.com for much more, and check out our members' website, redicemembers.com, for our full archives. All right, more coming up with Randall Carlson right now.